This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The As If Principle, The Radically New Approach to Changing Your Life by Richard Wiseman, performed by Ralph Lister. To Ronald and Brenda. If you want equality, act as if you already have it. William James, 1884. A brief introduction. It's time for positive action. Self-help gurus and business coaches preach the same simple mantra. If you want to improve your life, you need to change how you think. Force yourself to have positive thoughts and you will become happier. Visualize your dream self and you will enjoy increased success. Think like a millionaire and you will magically grow rich. In principle, this idea sounds perfectly reasonable. However, in practice, the approach often proves surprisingly ineffective, with research showing that people struggle to continually think happy thoughts, that employees remain unmoved by imagining their perfect selves, and that those dreaming of endless wealth fail to make millions. Over a century ago, the brilliant Victorian philosopher William James proposed a radically different approach to change. Since then, researchers from across the world have carried out hundreds of experiments into James's theory and discovered that it applies to almost every aspect of people's lives. Perhaps most important of all, the work has given rise to a series of easy and effective exercises that can help people feel happier, avoid anxiety and worry, fall in love and live happily ever after, stay slim, increase their willpower and confidence, and even slow the effects of aging. This research has been presented at countless scientific conferences and published in academic journals, but it has rarely made its way into the public domain. In my previous book, 59 Seconds, I described a handful of these exercises. The As If Principle builds on this work by presenting the first accessible and comprehensive guide to James's radical theory. It reveals how everything you currently believe about your mind is wrong, shows that change does not have to be challenging, and describes a series of easy-to-implement techniques designed to improve several different areas of your everyday life. Throughout the book, you're going to be presented with interactive exercises that involve you changing your behavior. You might be tempted to read about these ideas, but not actually put them into practice. This attitude is perhaps understandable. After all, behaviors quickly become ingrained in our minds and soon start to feel like old friends. But please resist the urge. This book is all about the impact that your actions have on your mind, and the exercises encourage you to actually experience these phenomena rather than just read about them. You are about to encounter a new approach to change, an approach that is grounded in science, overturns conventional thinking, and provides a basis for the easiest, quickest, and most effective ways of changing your life. So, sit up straight and take a deep breath. Forget all about positive thinking. It's time for positive action. Chapter 1. How to be happy. Where we meet that adorable genius William James, turn the world upside down, learn how to create good cheer at will, and visit the Fun Factory. In the beginning was the deed. Faust, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. 1. The simple idea that changes everything. The world's first laboratory-based psychology experiment was carried out by the German psychologist Professor Wilhelm Wundt in 1879. This historic study was conducted in a small room at the University of Leipzig and reveals all you need to know about how Victorian scientists approached the human mind. Wundt could have celebrated the birth of experimental psychology by investigating any fascinating topic of his choosing. Perhaps why people fall in love, believe in God, or sometimes feel the need to kill one another. Instead, the humorless and indefatigable Wundt chose to conduct a strange, even bizarre experiment involving a small brass ball. Wundt and two of his students gathered around a small table and connected a timer, a switch, and a carefully designed metal stand. A brass ball was then balanced on the stand, and one of Wundt's students placed his hand a few millimeters above the switch. Seconds later, the ball was automatically released from the stand, and the timer sprang into action. The student slammed his hand down on the switch the moment that he heard the brass ball hit the table, which immediately halted the timer. By carefully recording the reading shown on the timer in his notebook, Wundt created psychology's first data point. It would be nice to think that after a day or so of ball dropping, Wundt would have closed his notebook, reported his findings, and moved on to something more interesting. Nice, but wrong. In fact, Wundt spent the next few years of his life observing hundreds of people responding to the same test. In the same way that physicists were trying to identify the fundamental nature of matter, so Wundt and his team were attempting to discover the fundamental building blocks of consciousness. Some of the participants were asked to press the switch the moment they heard the ball hit the table, while others were told to react when they became fully aware of the sound. In the first scenario, observers were asked to concentrate their attention on the ball, and in the second, they were asked to focus more on their own thoughts. When the tasks were performed properly, Wundt believed that the first reaction would represent a simple reflex, whereas the second was more of a conscious decision. Perhaps not surprisingly, many participants initially struggled to recognize the alleged subtle difference between the two conditions, and so were required to complete more than 10,000 trials before moving on to the experiment proper. After carefully wading through the resulting mass of ball-dropping data, Wundt concluded that the reflexive response took an average of 0.1 seconds and left the participants with a very weak mental record of the sound of the ball. In contrast, consciously hearing the sound produced an average reaction time of 0.2 seconds and resulted in a far clearer experience of the ball's impact. Having solved the mystery of the reflexive response, Wundt devoted the rest of his career to carrying out hundreds of similar studies. His approach proved surprisingly influential, and almost every other 19th century academic dabbling in matters of the mind followed in his footsteps. In psychology laboratories across Europe, researchers could hardly hear themselves think for the sound of brass balls dropping onto tables. In America, a young philosopher and psychologist named William James was having none of it. William James, born in 1842 in New York City, was a most remarkable man. His father was an independently wealthy, well-connected, eccentric, one-legged religious philosopher who devoted himself to educating his five children. As a result, much of James's childhood was spent receiving private tutoring, visiting Europe's leading museums and art galleries, and rubbing shoulders with the likes of Henry Thoreau, Alfred Tennyson, and Horace Greeley. James's older brother, Henry, would go on to find fame as a novelist, and his sister, Alice, as a diarist. Initially trained in painting, James abandoned the arts in his 20s and enrolled to study chemistry and anatomy at Harvard Medical School. In 1872, family friend and Harvard president, Charles Eliot, recruited James to teach courses in vertebrate physiology. James soon found himself drawn to the mysteries of the human psyche, and in 1875 put together America's first psychology course, later remarking that the first lecture in psychology that I ever heard was the first one I gave. Appalled by what he saw as the triviality of Wundt's work, James firmly believed that psychological research should be relevant to people's lives. Turning his back on brass balls and reaction times, James instead focused his attention on a series of far more interesting and pragmatic issues, including whether it was right to believe in God, what made life worth living, and if free will actually exists. Wundt and James didn't differ just in terms of their approach to the human mind. Wundt was formal and stuffy, his lectures serious and solemn, and his writing dull and turgid. James was informal and unpretentious, often walking around campus sporting a silk hat, cane, frock coat, and red-checked trousers. He frequently peppered his talks with jokes and light-hearted asides, to the extent that his students often felt the need to ask him to be more serious, and he produced accessible and often amusing prose. "As long as one poor cockroach feels the pangs of unrequited love, this world is not a moral world." James and Wundt also developed completely different ways of working. Wundt recruited a large team of students to conduct his carefully controlled studies. On their first day in Wundt's laboratory, each new intake of students would be lined up, and Wundt would move down the line, handing each of them a description of the research that they were required to conduct. Once the work was completed, he acted as judge and jury, and any students reporting results that failed to support their master's theories ran the risk of failing. In contrast, James loved to encourage free thought, loathed the idea of imprinting his ideas on students, and once complained that he had just seen a fellow academic applying the last coat of varnish to his pupil. The two great thinkers did little to hide their animosity for each other. James developed a poetic turn of phrase, causing some commentators to note that he wrote psychology papers like a novelist, while his brother, Henry, penned novels like a psychologist. Wundt, however, remained unimpressed, and once when he was asked to comment on James's writings, he replied, "It is beautiful, but it is not psychology." In reply, James complained about Wundt's altering his theories from one book to the next, noting, "Unfortunately, he will never have a Waterloo. Cut him up like a worm, and each fragment crawls. You can't kill him." Despite being vastly outnumbered by Wundt's army of supporters, James stood his ground. While almost every psychologist in Europe was obsessively carrying out increasingly esoteric variations of Wundt's classic ball-dropping experiment, James continued to stroll around Harvard in his red-checked trousers, encouraging his students to think about the meaning of life. James's persistence paid off. Open any recent psychology textbook, and you will find nary a passing reference to Wundt or his brass balls. In contrast, James's ideas are still widely cited, and he is seen as the founding father of modern psychology. First published in 1890, James's two-volume magnum opus, Principles of Psychology, was recently described by one leading historian as the most literate, most provocative, and at the same time the most intelligent book on psychology that has ever appeared. And both volumes are still considered required reading for students of behavioral science today. Harvard's psychology department named its building after James, and each year, the Association for Psychological Science gives its William James Fellow Award to the academic judged to have made the most significant intellectual contribution to psychology. James was perhaps at his best when he found mystery and substance in phenomena that most people tended to take for granted. In 1892, he reflected on the importance of this approach to understanding the human mind, and provided a few examples of the types of phenomena that had recently caught his attention. Why do we smile when pleased and not scowl? Why are we unable to talk to a crowd as we talk to a single friend? Why does a particular maiden turn our wits so upside down? The common man can only say, "Of course we smile. Of course our heart palpitates at the sight of the crowd. Of course we love the maiden, that beautiful soul, clad in that perfect form, so palpably and flagrantly made for all eternity to be loved." It was exactly this kind of thinking that led James to create his most controversial theory and turn our understanding of the human mind on its head. Toward the end of the 1880s, James turned his attention to the relationship between emotion and behavior. To the uninitiated, this may seem a strange choice of topic for a world-renowned philosopher and psychologist. Common sense suggests that certain events and thoughts cause you to feel emotional, and that this, in turn, affects your behavior. So, for example, you might find yourself walking along an unexpectedly dark street late at night, or being called into your boss's office and awarded a pay rise, or suddenly remembering a time you were 5 years old and fell down the stairs. These stimuli cause you to experience certain emotions. Perhaps the dark street makes you feel anxious, the pay raise makes you feel happy, and the memory of falling down the stairs makes you feel upset. These emotions then affect your behavior. Feeling afraid may make you sweat. Feeling happy may make you smile, and feeling upset may make you cry. Seen from this perspective, the link between how you feel and the way you act is as straightforward as it is unsurprising. Mystery solved, case closed. However, James's previous experience with seemingly straightforward psychological phenomena made him well aware that conventional wisdom can often be deeply misleading. Take, for example, James's work on memory. For years, armchair philosophers had suggested that memory operated much like a muscle, believing that the more you used it, the stronger it became. James wondered whether this was really accurate. To find out, he spent 8 days timing himself as he memorized 158 lines of the Victor Hugo poem Satyr, and discovered that the task took him an average of 50 seconds per line. Then, to exercise his memory muscle further, he devoted 20 minutes each day for the following 30 days, memorizing the entire first book of Milton's Paradise Lost. If the theory of the more you use it, the stronger it gets was correct, James hypothesized that he should be able to return to Satyr and learn the next 158 lines in less time than before. In fact, when he tried to learn another section of the poem, he discovered that it took him longer than before. The memory as muscle hypothesis was wrong. James wanted to explore whether there was an alternative to the common sense theory of emotion, and began his intellectual quest by thinking about how we go about deciding how other people feel. Imagine two photographs, the first depicting a smiling young couple, and the second depicting three co-workers sitting on a bench using their phones. Looking at the first photograph, try to imagine how the two people in the photograph are feeling. Now do the same with the people in the second photograph. Most people find this exercise easy. Almost everyone assumes that the people in the first photograph are probably having a good time and are likely to be experiencing happiness with just a hint of attraction. The second photograph elicits a quite different reaction, with most people concluding that everyone in the group is probably concerned and anxious, and that at least one of them appears to be in need of a comfort break. This simple exercise is based on an experiment first conducted by the legendary naturalist Charles Darwin in the mid-1800s. Darwin published 22 books in his lifetime, including the groundbreaking On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, and his lesser-known tome, The Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms, with observations on their habits. In 1872, Darwin published a seminal text on emotion, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, and described carrying out the first psychological study of emotions. A French physician named Guillaume Benjamin Armand Duchenne had previously applied painful electrical shocks to the muscles in a volunteer's face in order to study facial anatomy. When Darwin saw photographs of Duchenne's work, he was struck by how easily he associated emotions with the volunteer's expressions. Intrigued, Darwin showed some of the photographs to his friends and asked them to say which emotion the volunteer appeared to be feeling. Darwin's friends also reliably and effortlessly associated certain expressions with particular emotions, proving that the ability to know how others are feeling based on their facial expressions is somehow built into our brains. James read about Darwin's experiment and used it as a basis for his new theory about emotion. Darwin had shown that people are extremely skilled at knowing how another person feels from facial expression. James wondered whether exactly the same mechanism might also account for how they themselves experience emotions. He suggested that in the same way that you look at other people's expressions and work out how they feel, so you might monitor your own expressions and then decide what emotion you should experience. James originally proposed that any emotion is entirely the result of people observing their own behavior. Seen from this perspective, people smile not because they are happy, but rather always feel happy because they are smiling. Or to use James's more poetic way of explaining his radical hypothesis, you do not run from a bear because you are afraid of it, but rather become afraid of the bear because you run from it. James makes a clear distinction between our body's instinctive physical behavior in the face of stimulus, whether pulling our hands away from a flame, smiling at a joke, or instantly starting to turn on our heel at the sight of an angry bear, and how our brain observes that movement and, a split second later, produces an emotion. You see the bear, your body behaves by starting to run, and your brain decides, I'm afraid. More modern versions of James's theory view the relationship between emotion and behavior as a two-way street, suggesting, for example, that people smile because they are happy and also become happier when they smile. James never formally tested his theory because he found experimentation both boring and intellectually unrewarding. The thought of brass instrument and algebraic formula psychology fills me with horror. He was, however, a passionate pragmatist and lost no time exploring the potential practical implications of his idea. The notion of behavior causing emotion suggests that people should be able to create any feeling they desire simply by acting as if they are experiencing that emotion. Or as James famously put it, if you want equality, act as if you already have it. I refer to this simple but powerful proposition as the as-if principle. Behavior and emotion. Common sense suggests that the chain of causation is you feel happy, you smile. You feel afraid, you run away. The as-if theory suggests that the opposite is also true. You smile, you feel happy. You run away, you feel afraid. This aspect of James's theory clearly energized him more than any other. In one public talk, he described the potential power of the idea as bottled lightning and enthusiastically noted, "The sovereign voluntary path to cheerfulness is to sit up cheerfully, to look round cheerfully, and to act and speak as if cheerfulness were already there. To wrestle with a bad feeling only pins our attention on it and keeps it still fastened in the mind." James's theory met with a critical reaction from some of his peers. Wilhelm Wundt roundly condemned the idea, labeling it a psychologischen Scheinerklärungen, and presented his own account of emotion, which suggested that feelings were a Gefühl, defined as an unanalyzable and simple process corresponding in the sphere of Gemüth to sensation in the sphere of intellection. Good to get that sorted out. James defended his position, but the theory proved too radical for many of his more conventional colleagues and was quickly relegated to the filing drawer marked years ahead of its time. And there it lay for more than 60 years. 2. Testing a theory. In the late 1960s, A young academic named James Laird was studying for his doctorate in clinical psychology at the University of Rochester. During a training session there, Laird was asked to interview a patient while his supervisor watched through a one-way mirror. At one point in the interview, a rather unusual smile spread across the patient's face. Laird was intrigued by the smile and wondered how the patient had felt when he had produced the rather odd facial expression. As Laird drove home from the interview, he replayed the session in his mind and became fixated on the smile. Eventually, he forced his own face into the same expression to discover how it felt. Laird was amazed to discover that the smile instantly made him feel happier. Intrigued, he tried frowning and suddenly felt sad. Those few rather strange moments during his drive home changed the entire course of his career. When he reached his house that night, Laird went straight to his bookshelf, where he searched for information about the psychology of emotion. By chance, the first book he picked up was William James's Principles of Psychology. Laird read about James's long-lost theory and realized that it might explain why smiling in his car had made him feel happier. He was also amazed to discover that the theory had been confined to the history books and had never been properly tested. In order to do so, Laird invited volunteers into his laboratory, asked them to smile or frown, and then report how they felt. According to James, those who had been smiling should feel significantly happier than those who had forced a frown on their faces. However, worried that volunteers might be tempted to tell him what he wanted to hear, Laird wanted to find a way of making people smile or frown while concealing the true nature of the experiment. Eventually, he hit on a clever cover story. He told the volunteers that they would be participating in a study examining the electrical activity in their facial muscles and placed electrodes between the participants' eyebrows, at the corners of their mouth, and at the corners of their jaw. He then explained that changes in their emotion could affect the experiment, and so to rule out this possible source of error, they would be asked to report their emotions as the experiment proceeded. The electrodes were fake, but the clever cover story allowed Laird secretly to manipulate his volunteers' faces into a smile or frown. To create an angry expression, the participants were asked to draw down and pull together the two electrodes between the eyebrows and contract the ones on the jaw by clenching their teeth. For the happy expression, they were asked to draw back the electrodes at the corners of the mouth toward the back of the face. After they had contorted their face into the required position, participants were presented with a checklist containing a list of emotions, such as aggression, anxiety, joy, and remorse, and asked to rate the degree to which they were experiencing each. The results were remarkable. Exactly as James had predicted at the turn of the 20th century, the participants felt significantly happier when they forced their face into smiles, and significantly angrier when they were frowning. After the study, Laird interviewed his participants and asked them if they knew why they had experienced various emotions during the study. Only a handful put their emotional state down to their manipulated expressions, with the rest at a loss to explain the shift. In one of the interviews, a participant whose face had been contorted into a frown explained, "I'm not in any angry mood, but I found my thoughts wandering to things that made me angry. Which is sort of silly, I guess. I knew I was in an experiment, and I knew I had no reason to feel that way, but I just lost control." To make sure that the remarkable effort was genuine, other scientists set about attempting to replicate Laird's groundbreaking result. Rather than repeatedly placing fake electrodes on people's faces, each laboratory produced its own cover story. Inspired by photographers who make people smile by getting them to say the word cheese, researchers at the University of Michigan had participants repeatedly make an E sound, as in easy, to force their faces into a smile, or a U sound, as in Yule, to produce an expression nearer to disgust. Psychologists at Washington University attached a golf tee to the inner ends of their participants' eyebrows and then asked them to carry out one of two facial contortions. Participants in one group were asked to make the golf tees touch by drawing their eyebrows down and together, thus producing an unhappy facial expression. Those in the other group were asked to ensure that the ends of the golf tees didn't touch, thus creating a more neutral expression. In perhaps the best known of the studies, researchers in Germany told participants that they were investigating a new way of teaching people who were paralyzed below the neck to write. Half of the participants were asked to support a pencil horizontally between their teeth, forcing their faces into a smile, and the other half were asked to hold the pencil between their lips, pulling their faces into a frown. Participants repeatedly chanting E, keeping their golf tees apart, or supporting a pencil between their teeth, suddenly felt significantly happier. Time and again, the research showed that Laird's results were genuine and that James's theory was correct. Your behaviour does influence how you feel, and so, as a result, it is possible to manufacture emotions at will, as the as-if principle predicts. Excited by the results, researchers set out to discover the impact that the principle has on your body and brain. How to be happy in an instant. Around the turn of the last century, the Russian theatre director Konstantin Stanislavski revolutionized drama by creating method acting. A key part of this approach is to encourage actors to experience genuine emotion on stage by controlling their behavior. This technique, often referred to as the magic if I was really experiencing this feeling, how would I behave, has been adopted by several famous performers, including Marlon Brando, Warren Beatty, and Robert De Niro. The same technique has been used in laboratory experiments exploring the as-if principle. Let's imagine that you are taking part in a study to test the as-if principle. At the start of the study, you would be asked to rate how cheerful you feel on a scale between 1, how would you feel if you'd just fallen down an open manhole, and 10, how you would feel if you'd just seen your worst enemy do exactly the same thing. Next, you would be asked to smile. However, there is more to acting happy than simply forcing your face into a brief, unfelt smile that finishes in the blink of an eye. Instead, you would be asked to follow these instructions. 1. Sit in front of a mirror. 2. Relax the muscles in your forehead and cheeks and let your mouth drop slightly open. In scientific circles, the expression that you have on your face right now is referred to as neutral and acts as a blank canvas. 3. Contract the muscles near the corners of your mouth by drawing them back toward your ears. Make the resulting smile as wide as possible and try to ensure that the movement of the cheeks produces wrinkling around the base of your eyes. Finally, extend your eyebrow muscles slightly upward and hold the resulting expression for about 20 seconds. 4. Let the expression drop from your face and think about how you feel. Do you feel more cheerful than before you started? What number would you give to this new feeling on the scale of 1 to 10? Most people report that the exercise has made them feel happier. As predicted by William James more than a century ago, just a few seconds changing your facial expression has a big impact on how you feel. To boost your level of good cheer, incorporate this type of smiling into your daily routine. Create a fun way of reminding yourself to do this by drawing two self-portraits of yourself wearing a huge smile. Draw one of the portraits on a sheet of letter-sized paper and the other on a small piece of paper that is about 2 inches square. Make the portraits as humorous and happy-looking as possible. Finally, place the large portrait somewhere prominent in your home and the smaller one in your wallet or purse, and use them as a cue to help you remember to smile. Body and brain. Paul Ekman from the University of California has devoted his career to studying facial expressions and emotion. During a long and distinguished career, he has produced the definitive guide to facial expression, a 500-page treatise showing how the 43 facial muscles combine to produce thousands of expressions. I advised law enforcement agencies across the world on the best ways of identifying whether someone is telling the truth from his or her facial expressions, and helped to create the hit television show, Lie to Me. Toward the start of his career, Ekman was intrigued to hear about the notion that altering people's facial expressions could make them feel either relaxed or angry, and wanted to discover how the as-if principle affects the body. His remarkable results paid tribute to the power of James's theory. Ekman invited volunteers into his laboratory, where he attached them to a machine that monitored their heart rate and skin temperature. He then asked each participant to carry out two tasks. The first was designed to make them feel genuine anger and involved thinking about an event in their lives that had made them feel angry, then mentally reliving that event as vividly as possible. For the second one, they produced only the facial expression of anger. Eyebrows down and together, raised upper eyelid, lower lip up, and lips pressed together. This procedure was then repeated for several emotions, including fear, sadness, happiness, surprise, and disgust. Not surprisingly, the genuine emotional memories triggered certain patterns in participants' physiology, with, for example, fear producing a high heart rate and low skin temperature, and happiness resulting in a low heart rate and higher skin temperature. Remarkably, exactly the same physiological pattern emerged when people adopted a facial expression. When they looked fearful, their heart rate rocketed and skin temperature dropped. When they put a smile on their faces, their heart rates fell and their skin temperature increased. Curious to discover whether this mechanism was hardwired into the human psyche, Ekman and his team journeyed across the world and repeated his study with the inhabitants of a remote island in western Indonesia. The results were identical to those found in the West, suggesting that the as-if principle is not a product of Western culture, but rather the deep-seated product of our evolutionary past. Ekman's findings showed that behaving as if you are experiencing an emotion does more than influence how you feel. It also has a direct and powerful effect on your body. More recently, researchers have built on this work by using the latest technology to discover how the as-if principle affects the brain. If you were to cut off your head and examine the region of the brain closest to the top of your spine, you would see two almond-shaped pieces of tissue on either side of the spinal cord. These are the amygdala, named after the Latin for almond. They form a very small but very well-connected part of the brain that plays a key role in almost every aspect of your everyday life. The amygdala is central to emotional experiences, especially fear. The key role that the almond of horror plays in fear was recently illustrated by scientists studying a remarkable patient referred to as SM. SM suffers from Urbach-Wiether disease, a rare genetic disorder that causes the amygdala to degenerate. After interviewing SM, the scientists noticed that she described several incidents in her life when she should have experienced fear, but didn't. In perhaps the most dramatic of these, SM was unfortunate to be attacked in a local park. Her attacker held a knife to her throat and threatened to stab her. SM said that she didn't feel afraid at the time, but instead noticed a nearby church and calmly said, "If you're going to kill me, you're going to have to go through my God's angels first." Confused, the attacker suddenly let her go. Intrigued, the scientists set out to scare SM. They took her to an exotic pet store and asked her to handle snakes and spiders. SM showed no reaction and had to be stopped from touching the more dangerous ones. Next, they took her to an allegedly haunted house and showed her horror movie clips. Again, nothing. Proof that a fully functioning amygdala plays a key role in experiencing fear. A few years ago, scientists decided to conduct the ultimate test of James's hypothesis by putting participants in a brain scanner and asking them to contort their faces into a fearful expression. Unlike the psychological studies that had been conducted throughout the preceding few decades, the participants did not have to tell the experimenters how they were feeling. Instead, the researchers just looked directly inside participants' brains, saw a highly active amygdala, and could conclude that the participants were indeed experiencing genuine fear. In doing so, the researchers obtained the ultimate proof that behaving as if directly influences your brain. The as-if principle has been used to manufacture happiness in laboratories across the world and has the power to have an instant impact on people's bodies and brains. But does the effect work in the real world? Could it even be employed to cheer up an entire nation? It was time to find out. The Science of Happiness Project. I have conducted several mass participation experiments during my career. These studies have involved tens of thousands of people and examined a range of topics, including the psychology of lying, how a jury is swayed by a defendant's appearance, and whether people can tell the difference between cheap and expensive wine. They couldn't. A few years ago, I arranged for thousands of people across Britain to take part in a large-scale study into happiness. Psychologists have created all sorts of techniques for promoting happiness, and I wanted to discover which was the most effective. Also, because other research had shown that happiness can spread through groups of people, like infectious disease, with people catching emotions from one another, I wondered whether thousands of happier people might act as a catalyst and cheer up the entire country. Before the start of the study, I commissioned a national survey to measure the mood of the country. All of the respondents were asked to rate how cheerful they felt on a 7-point scale, where 1 corresponded to not at all cheerful and 7 to very cheerful. 45% of the population awarded themselves a 5, 6, or 7. The study was then announced in the national media. Everyone who was interested in participating was asked to visit the project's website and rate how happy they felt. More than 26,000 people responded. All of the participants were randomly assigned to one of a handful of groups and asked to carry out various exercises designed to make them happier. A number of the groups used some of the most popular "think yourself happy" exercises, involving, for example, creating a sense of gratitude or reliving happy memories, while participants in one of the other groups were asked to follow James's advice and smile for a few seconds each day. A week later, the participants came back to the website and again rated how happy they were. When it came to increasing happiness, those altering their facial expressions came out on top of the class. Powerful evidence that the as-if principle can generate emotions outside the laboratory, and that such feelings are long-lasting and powerful. After the study, we conducted another national happiness poll. People were again asked to rate how cheerful they felt on the 7-point scale, and this time, 52% put themselves in the top half. Assuming there are 60 million people in the country, this 7% rise corresponds to just over 4 million people reporting that they felt happier after the study. Was the increase due to our project? It is impossible to know for sure, but there were no obvious changes in the other factors that might have affected the mood of the country, such as a sudden rise in the amount of sunshine, drop in rainfall, or particularly heartening news stories. So we like to think that William James helped cheer up an entire nation. 3. The Value of Fun. William James not only speculated that smiling makes people feel happier, but also that all aspects of behavior, including the way people move and speak, would influence how they felt. To discover if he was correct, psychologists started to walk the walk and talk the talk. Research shows that in the same way that there are only a very small number of core facial expressions, so there are only 6 basic walking styles. Striders, for example, take long steps, walk with a bounce, and let their arms swing back and forth. In contrast, shufflers tend to take small steps and have drooping shoulders. The work also showed that people associate each of the walking styles with different emotions, with striders being perceived as happy and shufflers as sad. Psychologist Sarah Snodgrass from Florida Atlantic University wanted to discover whether changing the way people walked would influence how they felt. While pretending to be conducting a study on the effect of physical activity on heart rate, Snodgrass asked people to take a 3-minute walk in one of two ways. Half of the participants were asked to take long strides, swing their arms, and hold their head up high. In contrast, the others were asked to take short strides, shuffle along, and watch their feet. After enacting this real-life version of Monty Python's Ministry of Funny Walks, everyone rated how happy they felt. The results demonstrate the power of the as-if principle, with those who had been asked to take long strides feeling significantly happier than those who had been asked to shuffle. The as-if principle can also help bring people closer together moments after they meet. Sabina Koch from the University of Heidelberg is fascinated by the impact of movement on the mind, and her work into the psychology of dance has revealed that people feel happier when they move in a fluid way and unhappier when they make sharp and straight movements. Aware that it isn't easy to persuade people to get in touch with their inner gazelle in everyday life, Koch turned her attention to a more down-to-earth behavior, handshaking. Koch trained a group of experimenters to shake people's hands in one of two ways. Some of them learned how to shake hands in a smooth, flowing way, while others were shown how to produce sharper up and down movements. This crack team of intrepid handshakers then shook the hands of almost 50 participants. After each shake, Koch asked the participants how they felt. The results were remarkable. Compared to those subjected to the spiky handshakes, those who had been subjected to the smooth, flowing shake were happier, felt psychologically closer to the experimenter, and rated the experimenter as more likable and open. The smooth handshake had made participants behave in a way that is associated with happiness, and this, in turn, had made them both feel better and think more of the person they had just met. Other work has examined whether the words that you say and the way that you say them also influence how you feel. In the late 1960s, American clinical psychologist Emmett Velton wanted to create a quick and easy way of generating good cheer in the laboratory. What would happen, he wondered, if people spoke as if they were happy and confident? To find out, he assembled a group of volunteers, randomly split the participants into two groups, and handed each group a stack of cards. For the first group, the top card in the stack explained that they were about to see a series of statements and were required to read each statement out loud. The next card contained the first of the statements. Today is neither better nor worse than any other day. As instructed, the participants read the statement out loud and then turned over the card and moved on to the second statement. I do feel pretty good today, though. Slowly but surely, the participant moved through all 60 cards, with the statements becoming increasingly positive. Those in the second group were asked to read a series of statements that were not designed to get them talking like a positive person, and so spent the sessions reading various facts out loud. For example, Saturn is sometimes in conjunction beyond the Sun from the Earth and isn't visible. The Orient Express travels between Paris and Istanbul. And the Hope Diamond was shipped from South Africa to London through the regular mail service. At the end of the procedure, Velton asked all of the participants to rate how happy they felt. Those who had said positive statements about themselves were in a wonderful mood. In contrast, those who had been reflecting on Saturn, the Orient Express, and the Hope Diamond flatlined. Encouraged by Velton's results, Other psychologists quickly adopted the procedure, and it is now used to cheer up experimental participants across the world. And it isn't just about reading single statements. In another study, Elaine Hatfield from the University of Hawaii and her colleagues had a group of participants read a short paragraph describing a fictitious scenario in which their friends had thrown them a wonderful surprise birthday party. In contrast, another group read a paragraph describing how they had just heard that a member of their family had been diagnosed with an illness. Saying the two different sets of words affected the participants' moods, with the people hearing about a good time feeling much better than those speaking about the family illness. Getting the participants to speak as if they were in a good or bad mood had the power to genuinely affect their emotions. The as-if principle is not just about forcing your face into a smile. It applies to almost every aspect of your everyday behavior, including the way that you walk and the words that you say. Excited by these findings, academics quickly set about exploring other ways of using the as-if principle to cheer people up in an instant. Happy talk. Can you really talk to yourself and make yourself feel happier? Find out by doing the following two exercises. First, read each of the following statements out loud to yourself. Try to sound as convincing as possible, as if you are spontaneously saying the statements to a friend. Don't rush the task, but rather speak slowly and leave a little time before moving on to the next sentence. Most people find the task odd at first, but quickly get used to it. 1. I feel surprisingly good about myself today. 2. I think that I can make a success of things. 3. I am glad that most people are very friendly toward me. 4. I know that if I set my mind to something, it will usually turn out well. 5. I feel very enthusiastic right now. 6. It's as if I am full of energy at the moment and enjoying what I am doing. 7. I feel especially efficient today. 8. I'm very optimistic at the minute and expect to get along very well with most of the people I meet. 9. I'm feeling very good about myself and the world today. 10. Given the mood that I am in, I feel particularly inventive and resourceful. 11. I am pretty certain that most of my friends will stick with me in the future. 12. I feel my life is very much under my control. 13. I am in a great mood and want somebody to play some wonderful music. 14. I am enjoying this, and I really do feel good about myself. 15. This feels like one of those days when I'm raring to go. How do you feel now? For most people, the procedure results in a boost in happiness. Now try saying aloud the following paragraph. Again, try to make your words sound natural and enthusiastic. It might help to imagine that you are having a telephone conversation with a friend. Feel free to improvise and come up with your own positive version of events. This has been a great day. It's my birthday, and you will never guess what happened. I was invited to my friend's house earlier this evening, and when I arrived, I found out that he had arranged a surprise birthday party for me. It was amazing. Almost everyone I knew was there, and some people had made a real effort to be part of the event. They had baked me a cake, brought me presents, and even sang happy birthday. I will remember the day for the rest of my life, and I am so lucky to have these friends. Make 'em laugh. In 1995, Madan Kataria was working as a family physician in Mumbai, India. While researching a magazine article on the science of laughter, he learned about the medical benefits of laughter and decided to try to introduce more chuckles and guffaws into people's lives. Kataria came up with a strange plan. At 7 o'clock one morning, He went to his local park and persuaded four people to tell each other jokes and laugh. Everyone enjoyed the session, and Katario decided to repeat the exercise the following week. The group soon grew, and more than 50 people were turning up for the sessions. Katario had created the world's first laughter club. In his original meetings, everyone would stand in a circle and then take turns telling a joke. Initially, all went well, but after a few weeks, people ran out of clean jokes and started to use more questionable material. The laughter came to a sudden halt when two women threatened to leave because of sexist jokes, causing Katario to explore other ways of putting a smile on people's faces. Eventually, he had a world-changing moment. He wondered whether people would get the same benefits from laughter if they chuckled away without hearing any jokes. The Laughter Club was initially skeptical, but eventually agreed to put their mother-in-law jokes on the back burner and try Katario's new approach. Within moments of acting as if they had heard a great joke, many members of the group found themselves feeling surprisingly euphoric. Contagion quickly kicked in, and soon almost everyone was giggling. Word about Katario's new and surprisingly effective way of inducing good cheer quickly spread, and laughter clubs sprang up across the world. Intrigued, psychologist Charles Schaefer from Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey decided to discover whether behaving like someone who had just heard a great gag really does make people feel good. He set up his own experimental laughter club and compared the effects of laughing with smiling. Schaefer split volunteers into three groups. One group was asked to spend a minute smiling, and another was required to spend the same amount of time laughing out loud. Concerned that any changes reported by those in the second group may have been due to the physical exertion caused by side-splitting laughter, Schaefer wanted the third group to carry out a task that was equally as energetic, but not associated with having a good time. After much head-scratching, Schaefer asked the students in the third group to howl like a wolf. Although a clever control, the howl like a wolf exercise was not without its problems. At first, the students in this group were somewhat confused and uncertain about how best to contact their inner wolf. To solve the problem, Schaefer stood in front of the group and personally demonstrated how to role-play a wolf howling at the moon. He later reported that seeing a senior professor behaving in this way quickly caused the students to become significantly less self-conscious. After much smiling, laughing, and howling, Schaefer asked everyone to assess their mood. The more the students behaved as if they were having a good time, the happier they became. Those who smiled became happier, and those who laughed out loud became elated. Howling like a wolf had very little effect on happiness, showing that the effect of the laughter was not due to physical exertion. William James's theory had been proven accurate again. Schaefer didn't.